We are going to hear from Jeremy Nordmo, who is from SIL International. We'll have 20 minutes of presentation followed by your questions. Thanks.
Thank you. I'll just point of introduction, I'm the Director of Language and Culture Archives at SIL International. So, I'm going to start with just an overview, introductory. Many archive programs are preserving linguistic and cultural resources produced by contemporary programs, contemporary researchers. But what about those materials produced in the past by in past programs, past research projects going back 50 years, 100 years, and to what degree are we responsible to preserve data collected in the pre-digital era? And share a little bit about SIL's background. We have 78 years of experience in language development, and our early years are characterized by language description and publication focused. In 1947, we established a corporate bibliography, tracking and preserving our publications. And a progression of thought led to a change in 2000, establishing the archives and expanding our role to preserve primary and raw resources as well. And we're excited to debut a new website as of 2 weeks ago. And providing access to our archives catalog and resources through there. So there's a picture of our the archives homepage. A little bit about our challenge in archiving. The language development projects we have are over 2,500, past and present. Approximately 750 of these projects are now inactive. We have about 1,000 retired staff still living. We have another 2,300 staff active in language development activities. We have a larger staff than that, but those are just the ones assigned to a given linguistic or ecological effort. Our first generation is already passed, represented by Ken Pike, perhaps our most well-known researcher. So I'd like to introduce you to a good positive case study first. So Carolyn Orr worked in four languages, Quechua, Quechua languages in Ecuador and Peru. She joined SIL in 1950. And prior to her retirement in the late 90s, we had in the archives bibliography about 50 items, all publications, all secondary material, some pedagogical, but as well as descriptive and translation. So she approached the archives in 2011 with a considerable collection of primary data, including 71 audio tapes and 508 transcripted texts. This accession marks obviously a substantial increase in the amount of knowledge that we now can provide about the language, as well as a more complete picture of what her work was. And here's just a scan of one of those texts. And again, it's available through our website now. So thinking about these endangered resources are these things that are in the possession of individual linguists and are primarily analog in nature. What is it that it causes them to be endangered? A couple things. Ownership is one key aspect, and that is the material generally seen as the personal property of the researcher. It's true in SIL, I'm sure it's true around almost universally. We've adopted an academic approach to rights often, which is giving deference to the individual researcher. As a result, it's totally up to the individual, not the institution, as to whether or not the materials get archived, preserved, and whether or not the value is actually attributed to the item long term. Passive institutional policy, of course, has a role to play. We didn't always encourage or require archiving, and we focus still so much on contemporary work and leave the past, what's done in the past, well, you know, it's just too late. Also, another role, another aspect of why things are endangered is good intentions. People don't intend not to archive, they're busy. Some of our people never retire. They formally retire, but they still have that grammar to finish, or, oh, well, I'm still working on the dictionary. And so they want to maintain control of the data until they're finished. And that's an open-ended prospect. And so what happens, of course, when their health deteriorates or they pass away untimely? Often that we find in our organization, there's not a system of estate planning to say, oh, what do I do about my data? We talk estate planning, that seems so non-academic, but how do we deal with the data that we've amassed over our career? And should we be, as archives, encouraging linguists to think about this? And heirs and executors, they don't realize what they've got on their hands. So let me share a nightmare story. This was actually something outside of our organization we became aware of. Staff member of a small U.S. college compiled a series of field recordings while on a sabbatical, traveled all around the world visiting SIL teams as well as other language projects. He was primarily interested in ethnomusicology, so most of this was in the arts realm. And he took those recordings back, used them in his teaching, and played them for students. And in his retirement, began to think about, oh, what do I do? I want to see these preserved. I don't want to lose them. It's a valuable collection. He actually contacted us, and he actually contacted our field team in the Philippines. So it wasn't even contacting our office in the U.S. So that started a series of conversations. We contacted his institution, the library in there, said, yeah, we'd be interested in working in collecting this and preserving it. We started to get that process underway. And then his health deteriorated to the point where he apparently did not have the ability to make his wishes known. And so his children, unaware of all these things going on, discarded the entire collection, or most of it. All but 12 recordings were thrown out. And I don't even know how those 12 got saved. So this is the kind of thing that we're dealing with in SIL in particular. Is the we're seeing valuable, potentially very valuable, unique resources that are in danger of being lost forever. And, another challenge, of course, in particularly with analog materials, is that due to the nature of the fieldwork, many of the resources originate and are stored for significant periods of time in environments unfriendly to preservation. So we're receiving boxes of moldy tapes, tapes that have no tape heads because they've been eaten by insects. So it presents a challenge just to, how do we stabilize the material before we can even digitize? And then metadata is another huge challenge. Particularly when people leave archiving to the end. They, you know, oh, well, I'll archive it one day, right? I'll get to it. And it suddenly, you know, their career They've gone from 5 years into their career to 50 years into their career, and they still haven't gotten to it. And it's now a huge task. Progressive archiving is definitely the way to go. So we're doing it in little bits. We have a lack of knowledge management. Some researchers have not adequately documented the metadata to begin with. They've not organized their material, labeled their tapes, provided spreadsheets. And these are practices now, good best practices in research, but they weren't done 30 years ago. Content may be so unique that a researcher may be the only one who can identify the language if no contextual clues are provided. We get mystery tapes. What do we do with those? Archivists and other colleagues have no expertise. I'm not a linguist. I'm a historian by training. And that's the case with a lot of people in archives. We come in with other expertise, but we have no way of being able to supply that information and do that detective work. Or it takes a lot of, or we don't have the resources and the luxury of the time to do the detective work. And in the absence of the researcher piecing together useful resource descriptions is exponentially more difficult. We recently received an ethnomusicologist's collection of 100 recordings. However, she's no longer capable. She's still living, but she's no longer capable of providing any description. So now we're relying on third parties having no direct knowledge to provide the metadata. And the result is a recording collection with barely adequate metadata, much less the meta documentation level of description. In one case, in this particular collection, the language is still undetermined at this point. I think it might be possible. I mean, I've already got a sense of, okay, how do I chase this down to say, okay, this contributor here, they've done work in that language, so maybe this is the same language as that language. But I, as the archivist, don't have the authority to confirm that or validate those kinds of assumptions. So I need somebody else to go chase that down, and I don't have a staff that large to do that. Keep getting ahead of myself here. Insufficient archive staff to dedicate any of them to gathering and describing endangered collections full time. My staff is, I have nine members of my staff. And then we have a network, building a community of practice within the organization of others relating in archiving. But it's a massive effort. You saw the scale and scope of what we're trying to do. And so we need a linguist and a grassroots approach. And our first priority is to support routine archiving among current teams so that we don't produce yet more backlog. So one of our strategies is to provide staff with tools for self-archiving in an institutional repository. We rolled out a DSpace instance 2 years ago, and at the same time created a tool called RAMP. I talked about that in 2011 at SOAS, and you can find the citation will be in the PDF version if you're more interested. And also we have a poster downstairs talking about analyzing the use of RAMP in the last year. So our strategy for rescuing these endangered resources. First of all, I want to share a few assumptions. Our assumptions are retired language workers possess unique knowledge about their research data, that many of them lack the technological skills or comfort level required to self-archive, that students of linguistics and related fields would benefit from time spent with veteran field workers, and that students have the time, interest, flexibility, and technical skills ideal for resource and data collection. So how can we pair them up? We over the last 2 years have endeavored to do just that. We've marketed data collection service to staff. This is for short periods of time. And we've then paired up the student or the intern with the researcher. They provide the description, but the student provides the transcription into the RAMP tool. We do some digitization, either a whole digitization or maybe just a partial sample for the time being, just to get some sort of image in there. And then we package those descriptions and upload them into the institutional repository. In our implementation in 2011, we had one paid internship that lasted 11 weeks, and in 2012, we had two volunteer internships that lasted 10 weeks. And our results, in 2011, we had 156 texts and 74 audio tapes representing 9 languages. In 2012, we had 762 individual resources representing 10 languages. Among them were audio texts collected in Peru, including the only known recording of the now extinct Anabo language. We have field notebooks and one scrapbook related to the Loded language of Malaysia, 82 slides documenting the Jibaro language of Peru, and 147 manuscripts of cultural stories from the Central Subanon community of the Philippines. And we also have, I want to introduce you to Karen Volrath. She was 19 years spent in Papua New Guinea among the Hewa. Her primary role was a community nurse. She's also a mother and a wife of a linguist translator. She compiled on her own, really under no compulsion to do this for any program, on her own compiled a series of 15 journals recording daily weather conditions, activities, cultural observations, logs of overnight visitors from the community, and medical cases and much more. She recorded community births, deaths, kinship data in three series of index cards. So this is a treasure trove of primary and raw data about climate, culture, language, and population in just one community. And this was discovered through this program, just sending the word out. And we were only doing this in the Dallas community, so it's still within a very small subset of our total community. So just exciting to see this kind of material coming out, bubbling up to the surface. Here's a picture of one of those journal entries. And lessons. So marketing the collection service garnered mixed results. Some respondents had previously approached the archives already. And they approached the archives, we said, okay, yeah, we want to do that, but we don't have staff. Can you wait until we do have some help? And as soon as we got help, we said, oh yeah, definitely want to pair you up. Approximately half the respondents weren't even retired. They're just current staff. They saw the announcement and they said, hey, I've got something. Will you archive it? And I'm not one to say no. Advocacy by a veteran staff member was more effective than any kind of advertisement or word of mouth. We have a literacy specialist approaching retirement age herself, so she has a level of trust and relationship that I, as the archivist, can't possibly leverage. So on my own. So that was real helpful. And we had the unintentional yet fruitful inclusion of materials from support staff. In SIL, support staff would be anybody in a non-linguistic or non-anthropological, non-research role. So medical staff, transportation staff, administrative staff, IT staff, archiving staff would fall under those. But these are people who also have encounters, cross-cultural encounters in the field, and have opportunities. Sometimes they take pictures, sometimes they write journals, and sometimes they do pencil sketches, the project harvested surprising types of material that we didn't expect. Birth records on 3x5 cards. Never would have expected that. And our respondents generally enjoy the experience and appreciate the help. We got overwhelmingly positive response from those who went through the process, those veterans. They just needed some help. in getting the process started. In some cases, for the non-retired staff, I'm hopeful that this is the first step towards getting them into self-archiving as well. Other lessons, digitization remains a key challenge, especially in short-term projects. We've got now a backlog of items that need to be digitized. And interns bring a varying technical skill, so they're not a one-size-fits-all kind of group. We had a digital native that didn't have a Facebook or a Twitter account. So, So, you know, you can't necessarily depend on them to be the same. And interns can sometimes bring their own technical assets. They brought laptops, digital recorder, they had software of their own. They had comfort and knowledge of software products that I couldn't have imagined or necessarily counted on. We did have some differences in using volunteers as opposed to, and when I say volunteers, unpaid versus paid staff. Obviously, from an administrative perspective, it's much easier to go with if somebody says, hey, I'll go and do all the legwork of getting you interns, do the recruiting, do the logistical administration, and all you have to worry about is managing their work. That's great, right? But on the other hand, I had to give up. They had responsibilities about 8 hours a week. So didn't have them full time. Volunteers sometimes lack enthusiasm for archiving. You know, they're not aware of what an archive is. They don't. Our paid intern had an interest in public history, had an interest in linguistics. So it was a really nice fit. Our other two interns had interest in linguistics, but not interest in archiving. So it was an opportunity to raise their awareness of the value. So it was a kind of a give and take there. And just real quick, I want to talk about our future plans. Obviously, we hope to do it again this summer. But we'd really like to pursue grant funding or some other method of funding to expand this model, hiring a program manager, partnering with academic programs to hire graduate research assistants, to go beyond our local Dallas area. We've got retirees living all over the United States and also all over the world. How do we approach them? And on-site digitization is a possibility. Adding a formal oral history program to capture that level of there's a little chance to get some meta documentation there, also expanding to even include active field programs, particularly active field programs that have been going on for 15 or 20 years, in which case they've already established a backlog of archiving. So thank you. And remember, be nice to archivists.
That's great. We have 10 minutes for questions. Yes.
Yeah, great that you do that work for your institution, and indeed you have materials for many, many languages all over the world. We also try to outreach, and indeed more and more people come to us and say, hey, I've got this stuff from my former supervisor, or I know somebody has this here, and mm-hmm. can you digitize it, can you archive it? And the problems are exactly those which you are. This is well known, right? The UNESCO
right.
said already in 2003 or so that 90% of our endangered language material is endangered as well. One question to your archive, will this all be publicly available? Because the question of access rights and so is also intriguing if you don't have access to the original speakers or to the researchers
right.
who collected the material, right?
Great question, and it is a question that's plaguing, I think everybody. I've asked around a couple people here, what is Paradisic doing? In the case of lacking informed consent, this is material that, was gathered before people were even thinking about, getting an IRB together. We're thinking about, we have it, right now we've got a large amount of material that's still behind is not accessible on the web and we're describing it, we're sharing the catalog, but we're not able to share the item because of that. We're thinking and considering a takedown policy and putting it up anyway, but we're being cautious as we approach that. Want to make sure that is the right. I want to hear what other institutions are doing in that respect. What is a cut? What's a good cutoff date? You know, at some point, you know, is it, you know, 1990 or is it 2005? You know, at what date is it reasonable to expect that they should have gotten an IRB and they should have informed consent? And at what point is it not reasonable? Can we find a grandfather clause kind of approach? It's easy when you're talking about something that's 30 years old. It's a lot harder when you're talking about something that's 15 years old or 10 years old. We still have a lot to learn in that respect, but we are considering some sort of takedown policy. Anybody else?
On that issue, I suppose, if you've got a depositor, then the depositor has a relationship with you, and they specify what the access condition should be.
Yeah.
So, it's covered, right? Regardless of what the relationship, their relationship with the speaker, you have to take their word that they have the right to deposit that material with you.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have that, then you're subject to normal copyright issues, which is 70 years after they're dead.
Right.
So,
yeah, our issue is generally with informed consent, you know, lack thereof. It's not the process in gives the depositor a series of, yes, this is something that should be distributed on the web, or no, this is something that we want to, you can talk about it, but let's, people have to ask, you know. So something similar, we don't have a subscribe yet. A method of having that progressive kind of access embedded into a website. I would say right now, the large majority of the approximately 30,000 things in the archive are not digitally available for anonymous download, but they are, if it's listed in the catalog, it is in theory available for research. But it has to be upon request at this point.
I think your job is a bit harder, Nick, than yours might be, because it's largely within one institution.
Yeah.
So SIL is still, from a field perspective, we might be looking to him to say what is an appropriate access policy for this, and he can't really just say, well, it's up to you, because he's representing SIL at national.
So you're saying that
I'm saying that if he was a third party, he could put it on me to make sure that I'm doing the right thing. Because this is one organization that wants to be roundly ethical, it's harder to put it on the individual.
Yeah. Yes.
So if you think about traditional archives and libraries in which the metadata about a book or somebody's papers are available electronically, we can look on the internet and figure out, okay, I need to go to Archive X to see what I need. What you're doing is essentially the same thing. So the idea of making everything immediately public doesn't seem like a barrier to me. It's what archives do, in that we store our materials, and if a researcher needs to use them, then they need to contact us or the linguist to get permission to use those materials. So I don't think that this question of IRB is that urgent right now, but the IRB laws did change in 2000, 2001, because I was doing my field work that year, and the rules that I set off into the field with were different than the rules that were in place when I got back. So there's your timeline right there for
okay.
IRB.
So, yeah, I had a feeling it was more recent than, but getting a sense of being safe, being ethical, so I anticipate hopefully being able to just unlock a lot more resources in the near future. And that's my desire, is to pursue more of an open access and anonymous download. It's far easier for me to with a small staff also to make things available for download rather than to have to process requests.
Right.
So.
Well, when you say anonymous download, do people have to set up a user account?
They do, and they fill in a profile.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not quite as elaborate a process, but it's a it's a free account. And by anonymous download, I mean it's still it's out there for anybody. There's not a subscription where they get vetted, and you sign up for the account, you put in an email address.
Right.
I mean, there's no way for me to really know
right.
that you're who you say you are. Anybody can fill out a profile and put anything. I don't know. Yeah, at some point, trust is trust. I mean,
we do that. We have the free automatic accounts as well, which gives you that user value.
Right.
But that's the most open category. So I was surprised you used the term anonymous.
Well, okay, yeah.
We think, because that's part of building the trust with the depositors. You say, well, there is no, like, click and play anonymous type.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, yeah. I guess I was using that term a little bit funny. So, I agree that, we kind of based our policy on what you were doing in terms of saying, I think we do want to know who the people are required just a little bit. Log in one time, create an account. Yes.
Can I mention one thing? When people do create their account, they give their name and, as you say, that could be anybody. But we do ask them, what is your endangered languages connection? And that's become the really powerful thing, because you do expect a little bit of narrative, and one can usually pretty, you can obviously see your robot filled in ones. One can see people being mischievous and so on. I mean, we don't apply a ruler and say it has to be a certain amount of connection, but it's a really good way to tell if that's actually a real person that's deliberately filled that in or not.
That's a great idea. Yeah. I'll have to take that back. So.
I would think that also provides you that meta documentation
mm-hmm.
data. I mean, you want to know who's using these resources to help you better present
right.
them, right? I mean, the users are just as important as
have a look at our
depositors.
Latest blog post exactly on that topic.
Yeah.
And possibly even being able to sign up to say, I want to know if this thing is updated. I don't know, I assume that's part of this idea of progressive archiving as well.
Ultimately.
Yeah.
So. Thank you, our time is up.
Thank you.
Enjoy the rest of that.